Hello, everybody. This is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure, number 149B. We're on page 636 in the book. Excuse me. We're in the appendix of the book, where we are discussing the astrological references from the Secret Doctrine and from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. It's a 60-page section of the book and has many profound ideas and the need for much correlation. So we've done one program so far on that, and our last little discussion was on the high ceremonial astrology. It depends upon the knowledge of the initiate of the immaterial, those immaterial forces and spiritual entities that affect matter and guide it. And perhaps I did not speak as much as I should have. Timing is all important. Because you cannot do this type of ceremonial astrology, unless working at propitious times, when the relationship between the deities, the heavenly bodies, are at the in the right configuration for what you wish to accomplish. So it's not only a question of how the spiritual entities, the immaterial forces, spiritual entities, the elemental and devic forces respond to certain words and symbols and certain types of invocations. It's a question of when they can best respond as well. So quite detailed knowledge of the cycles and some wisdom is required if we are going to be able to carry out in the new age a high ceremonial astrology for the purposes of bringing forward those types of events and manifestations which are required if the divine plan is to express itself. Number 11, our earth was created or fashioned by terrestrial spirits, the regents, the seven spirits of the seven planets, says AAB, being simply the supervisors. This is the first germ of that which later grew into the tree of astrology and astrology. Well, hidden forces were involved, and eventually, and the initiates began to understand what these forces were, and began to attempt to work with, let's just say, the ignorant did not understand, but worshipped, and the initiates did understand the methods to a degree. Seek to cooperate. The terrestrial spirits, these can be devas of the earth. I'm thinking particularly of the Agni Chaitans, you know, when it comes to etheric and physical manifestation. The Agni Chaitans may here be referenced. But of course, I suppose from the subtle principles of man, the Agnish Vatas and the Agnisurians were already active. The subtle aspects of the planetary logos. The great deities knew the methods of commanding these lower devas, and these were also conferred to the initiates. When the initiates brought forward this type of information, the people without knowledge tended to worship the great beings because of the information that was given. Which terrestrial spirits were involved? Well, as I say, certainly the Agni Chaitans in the Devic ranks must have been involved, because we're talking about the creation of the outer form, the etheric aspect of our planet and its outer form. When it comes to the creation of the astral body, which had to have happened in the process of descent and appropriation. It must have been the Agnusarians, and then a lower form of Agnishvata, or mental devas and elementals were involved when the mental vehicle of the planet was created. The method of appropriation of the vehicles has to be similar to that of the human being, and DK describes this. It can take quite a long time for the human being to create his inner vehicles, or recreate them, before coming forth as a manifested being through the process of procreation. And we would have to say the same on a much larger scale for the planetary spirits, the planetary logoi who are intending to manifest. Always the builders, the idea behind this is the lower builders must be guided. And they are guided by Raja Deva lords and their subsidiaries. There's a much more complex organization within the effective methods of working in the Deva kingdom than there is in the human kingdom at the present time. So all is well organized, and there, you know, the lords of each one of these subplanes, not just the Raja Deva lords of the systemic planes, but the lords of each one of the subplanes are equivalent to at least initiates of the fifth degree, maybe the sixth. The Raja Deva lords are equivalent to initiates, human initiates of the sixth degree, and sometimes I think the seventh degree may even be involved for some of them. So these are great beings who direct the blind and lesser beings. I would say the lower devas are not blind, nor are they deaf, but they are not self-conscious, and they follow direction. The lower devas are not blind or deaf, but are not self-conscious, and respond to direction from the self-conscious deva entities, such as the Raja Deva lords and their subsidiaries. And probably, you know, for the ruler of every sub-subplane, there is, for every sub-subplane, there is a ruler. We have 343 sub-subplanes on our cosmic physical plane. All of this is well regulated and comes under supervision by those who know certain pitches, symbols, sounds, colors, and color combinations. It's all a well-organized building process. And DK, in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, deals with a number of these different kinds of devas. You know, having gone through most of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire in a fairly meticulous manner, one sees immediately the need to do it again, because so much will necessarily escape us. It is a book written for initiates, we are told, but others can benefit from it. They just will not have the initiate understanding where that may be required. There are seven chief groups of such Dhyan Chohans, and I think by this he may mean, if we have reference to the last, to the previous statement, planetary spirits, perhaps. Yes, they are the primeval seven rays, especially in the sacred, the sacred planets, the logoi thereof. Hence, there are seven chief planets, the spheres of the indwelling seven spirits, each under each of which is born one of the human groups. Now, okay, what do we mean by that? Probably the seven root races. I wouldn't be surprised if I would not be surprised. I would not be surprised if our Aryan race is born under Mercury. And the next, perhaps, the sixth root race, maybe, under Venus. And what about the previous, what about the Atlantean race? Was that Martian, Neptunian? Was the Lemurian race, in a sense, born under Saturn? Maybe HPB deals with this. But these are just my thoughts at first. Maybe the sixth root race also will have a strong Neptunian content, just as the seventh root race in our particular round will have a strong Uranian content. Now, she's not talking so much, well, the chief ones are the logoi of the seven sacred planets, the chiefs are the logoi of the seven sacred planets. So she talks here, AAB talks about the regents, but let's just say that while these great spirits could have been the directing agencies in the building of our terrestrial sphere, there are, we should know, well, why is this not working? There are representatives. Representatives of these seven right here on our planet. Now, these are the seven spirits before the throne of our particular planetary logos. There are also the different chain lords that are representative, and the globe lords are representatives of these seven. So let's just say that the regents have their building, their agents who can cooperate in the building. And right here, I suppose, even on our little globe, we will have seven representatives. After all, Shambhala largely, and the Buddhas of Activity, they largely concern our globe, which is an entity and a structure that goes all the way up to the monadic plane, as far as I can see and understand. So whether the spirits of the seven planets would have to have been intimately involved, or whether their representatives could have been involved, that is a question, and it seems logical to me that the representatives on the sphere on which the building had to occur, or that had to manifest that particular sphere, let's say that, would be necessarily a part of the chain conducting supervision of the building. Okay, RPVS. RPV, RPVS. Very good. Representatives. Certain of these words, they're so long, you just don't want to be misspelling them all the time, so put them in the autocorrect to see if they work. RPVS, representatives. Indeed it did. Okay. So our Earth was created or fashioned by terrestrial spirits. And the directors can have been on the globe level, or those who were to take the place of the representatives of the planetary logoi on the globe level, on the chain level, and on the scheme level as well. Three different levels within our own planetary scheme, without having had to require that the actual logoi of the other planets were the active supervisors. They, I'm sure they were supervisors in some sense, but their representatives could have carried out that smaller task, it seems to me. All right. And the Dhyan Chohans, you know, it's a term that we use to represent a great meditating entity. And Chohan already tells you they are high. They're higher than our human Chohans. But there are Dhyan Chohans active on our planet right now that are not the planetary Kumaras. See, in this case, we're looking at the Dayan Chohans as if they are the spirits of the sacred planets, therefore are planetary Kumaras. But we can say, that even the solar angels are Dayan Chohans. D-H-Y-A-N, Chohans. And that, you know, there are planetary Kumaras, intraplanetary Kumaras, such as the Buddhas of Activity and the esoteric Kumaras, and there are planetary Kumaras themselves, which are the greater entities, the planetary Logoi. So a superior meditative entity, such as the solar angel, can be called a Dayan Chohan, but that is pretty well intraplanetary at the moment. And then we can go further and look at the seven spirits before the throne. What, the phone of God? The seven spirits before the throne as Dayan Chohans of a higher kind, just as there are planetary, intraplanetary Kumaras and actually planetary Kumaras. There are only seven planets specially connected with the Earth and 12 houses, but the possible combination of their aspects are countless. Now, I wonder why she... DK says that there will be revealed 12 planets as rulers of the 12 signs and the 12 houses. Right now, Vulcan is not yet revealed. It is the ruler of something, associated, I would say, probably with the second house. A non-sacred fourth ray and a non-sacred second ray planet, veiled respectively by the moon and the sun. As each planet can stand to each of the others in 12 different aspects, their combinations must be almost infinite. So all kinds of possibilities are possible with the planets with which we work and the signs and houses with which we work. But planets and houses, we're talking about a level of astrological expression which is pretty well concerned with the life of the ordinary individual, though if we spiral up the meaning of the houses, the planets and houses can have much to say about spiritual development as well, either something to overcome or something to use. It so much depends on what HPB means by specially connected with the Earth. So that would mean eight planets. At the time she wrote this, Neptune had been discovered, but Pluto had not. So this is interesting. Pluto would make the ninth planet, because it would be the Earth plus seven, which would be eight, plus Pluto, but forget Pluto, that would be eight, and Vulcan is not under consideration here, obviously. This was the time at which it was written. Vulcan is not under consideration here, but let me say this. If we go back to the chart on page 610, we see something really interesting, because Vulcan has a direct line straight down to the Earth, the fiery stones and the living stones. You know, the graduates of Vulcan are called fiery stones, and we, as Earth graduates, will one day be called living stones. The whole connection with the mineral kingdom, with the jewel and the lotus, with the diamond soul and so forth, is a Vulcanian Earth connection. So, but HPB was writing a long time ago here, in the 1870s and 80s here, and it's not possible for her to invoke discussion of Vulcan, though she probably well knew about it, and nor could she discuss Pluto. Both of them existed astrologically from the mythological angle, we can say. They were among the gods. So that when we look at the pantheon of gods, we do expect some kind of correlation with actual heavenly bodies. It may not be so in every case, but I think it is often so, whether these are asteroids or planetoids and so forth. So she's saying that astrological combinations are extremely numerous. So, and can account for all manner of activity and type of expression in our world. So we have many combinations to choose from, and as human beings, there's probably no type of circumstance that we cannot deal with based upon the astrological combinations that present themselves to us. Countless is right. Especially if the subsidiary aspects are used, and if different types of orbs are used, and different types of divisions of the zodiac are used. The complexity of astrology oftentimes puts people off. They say, why do I have to bother learning all that stuff? And I would say, well, maybe you don't. You know, maybe it would be just better to learn a few of the basics, because unless you're really inclined and drawn into this field, because even with a few of the basics, you can determine some very important factors which relate to your evolution, spiritual evolution, and the spiritual evolution of your fellow human beings. There's so much about direction in life which can simply be learned by understanding what is the proper ascendant, the sun and moon signs, and having a horoscope in which these are drawn up. Even if we know that we have always to move in the direction of the higher aspect of our rising sign, that would be one piece of invaluable information. Number 14, that which is the surviving entity in us is partly the direct emanation from and partly those celestial entities themselves. Partly a direct emanation and partly the celestial entities themselves. So what we are learning here is we are emanated cells, let's call it cells for the moment, of the planetary logoi, and even more so of our solar logos. We are affected by the quality of the being who emanated us. So we are, in a way, we are planetary spirits of a lower kind. PLT. Spirits of a lower kind. Some of us might come from Venus or from Jupiter or from Mars in our monadic origin. Or at least let's say that the monadic origin should be one of the sacred planets, and not one of the non-sacred planets, I think that's safer to say, and ultimately from the sun, but then what? Ultimately from the sun. Okay. Yeah, there we are. Because that that which we are finds its home within the sun. So we are, you know, in a way solar monads, but the history of the monad is something that extends back to the original divisions of the universal logos, the original emanative divisions of the universal logos. And we are all part of great emanations which went forth from that logos, those emanations themselves carrying with them a certain potential number of emanations. So we can retrace our origin back to the beginning of the emanative process of the universal logos. Do we always travel with our solar logos? Well, then the solar logos is a kind of cell too. Does it always travel with, as it is being retracted, with the cosmic logos of which it is a part? Does a cosmic logos always travel with a being called the one about whom naught may be said, of which it is a part, a small part? Well, I'm going to talk about a science that I really know very little about or nothing about. I'm calling it the science of emanative retraction. In other words, how are we reabsorbed and reamalgamated and fused, refused? there's also the science of emanation. And, or could we call it this? We call it this. The science of emanative distribution or distinction. I had another word just a minute ago here. Differentiation. That's it. The science of emanative differentiation. That would be an important one to know. In other words, we were there at the beginning. We are more than we imagine to be. We are the universal logos itself, and that universal logos itself is the absolute, essentially the absolute. You can't really call it a fragment of the absolute because the absolute has no fragments. The whole of absoluteness is found in every apparent fragment. So even in this entire universe with this tiny universal logos having in its algorithm only certain possibilities, it is in a way the entirety of the universal, the entirety of the absolute itself. And this is a great paradox and a great mystery, I would say. Okay. Meaning, you know, I'm meaning to give certain ideas here. The surviving entity in us, and really what is that after all? You know, I'd have to say that is the monad. Even the soul nature disintegrates in time. The one between comes forth and knows both time and space. But time destroys that middle one, and only being is. This is, as you may know by now, one of my favorite pages. It's in Dyna 2, which is page 285. Unity is, the one between comes forth and knows both time and God. Time and God. That's it, not time and space, time and God. But time destroys that middle one, and only being is. And by God, in this case, we do mean pure being, that which ever is. And so we talk about that which survives. That which, you know, there are subtle parts of the personality that survive death, but they don't last. And there is the ongoing egoic lotus, which may last 25 million years, let us say, or even longer. But it does not ultimately persist. The monadic vehicle does not ultimately persist. But the monad does, the essence of the monad. And what that monad is the ray of the absolute. The ray of the absolute is, in a way, the whole of the absolute. Because, you know, we cannot really subdivide the absolute. It is the absolutely indivisible. And every individual is also the indivisible, even though Maya and illusion make us think that there are separate entities. It takes a long time before one wants to give up one's distinctive ring pass knot as if it were a permanent surviving factor. It is not. So the one which is the surviving entity is really the monad, and the monad can be the emanation of the planetary logo or a particular planetary logos, but also of a solar logos, the monad is that which finds its home within the sun, and of beings beyond. We cannot say that our ultimate monadic source is the Solar Logos. It cannot be, because the Solar Logos has for its ultimate monadic source something else, and that something else, and so, and it all goes back to the one and only Logos of a universe, which is the source. But even that Logos has its source. And finally, you know, the ultimate source, well, let me put it like this. I will do that. The ultimate ULT. Well, I want that. I want that word. Please forgive me for this, but here we go. Ultimately, but ultimate. Ultimate. All right, we'll do it this way. ULT. And it's a word I like to use quite a bit, so why take the time to write it out every time? Ultimate. N-U-L-T-L. Okay, very good. The ultimate. So the ultimate source of anything is the sourceless source. So, and this is the ultimate source of our entire universe. The sourceless source. That which arises only from itself but does not really arise. That which ever is, and, you know, going back to those six parts of stanza, six parts of formula three, God is, it simply is, the sourceless source. Simply is. It's the eternal parent which has no parent. And that is a hard thing to fathom until we begin to change our approach to identification. And instead of identifying with matter form, we begin to identify with ever subtler states until there is implied the final state which we are, but which in cosmos I don't think we can really identify with. All right. The descent and reascent of the monad or soul cannot be disconnected from zodiacal signs. So there are, that's not it. Let's get back to our little red bracket there. There are, Logoi of a great nature, and from them we came, as I have been saying. You know, the monad is a, let's just call it a cell of a planetary logos, of a sacred planetary logos. The monad is a cell of a sacred planetary logos. And as a cell, it is implanted in the Earth, which is a non-sacred planet, implanted in the Earth temporarily. And all this takes place before the descent and re-ascent. So we are the representative of a sacred planet, ultimately the representative of the sun, or the solar logos, at least within our system. But as well, monads have a source connection with one or other of the zodiacal constellations. I wonder when we try to find our place within the one about whom naught may be said. Will it be so that as we trace our unchanging monadic ray, we find it to be associated with one of the signs or one of the constellations of the zodiac? So we descend at different times. We can say this, the monad, the human monad, whoop, oh good, the human monad descends or begins its pilgrimage at different times under different or differing constellational rulership, and under different planetary rulership, and perhaps in a particular way according to the sacred planet in which it is a cell. We know that individualization itself took place with Cancer, the sign Cancer prominent, and under Gemini and Leo, those three, and Sagittarius was involved too, those four signs. But different monads begin their expression as a causal body at different times. So let's just say there will probably be a zodiacal rulership of our egoic lotus. And they and this rulership will differ from 11 other kinds. And maybe, who knows, there may be a sun sign and a kind of rising sign in relation to the rulership of our egoic lotus. So a very sacred sign, which is what the this particular ego is to achieve, and something that tells us more maybe about his group, maybe the sun sign in which the egoic lotus was formed. All of this lies back in the history of the formation of our egoic lotuses at the time of individualization, but then some of us have to go back to the moon chain or the previous solar system, and what were the astrological circumstances then for the formation of the egoic lotus. The solar angels were not involved, and there was an upward striving and aspiration of animal man which led to an evocative response from the monad, and hence to the establishing of a kind of egoic lotus which we still retain, because we know that even before coming into this chain there were human individuals who had an egoic lotus with one or more petals open, which they had worked out on the moon chain, or who knows about the previous solar system. But since the zodiac is the heart and the head center of the one about whom naught may be said, and since that great being has to, I would say, endure in one state or another while the lesser parts of itself are evolving, the zodiac would have been important even in those early days. So we can assume, what's the result of all this? We can assume that in our soul nature, we are colored by one or maybe two signs of the zodiac. This may also be true of our monadic nature. We are monads of a certain ray, and maybe there's a superior ray and a secondary ray in our monadic nature, but maybe we are monads of a certain zodiacal coloring as well. And this may have a lot to do with our cyclic timing as monads. Maybe we are monads of a certain zodiacal coloring, and this may affect our monadic cycles. You can just get a little idea of this incredible possible science of cycles and science of cyclic influence. So we come maybe from our relationship as a monad is related to a certain sacred planet, and also of course to the Earth where we are, related to our sun, to our solar logos, may be related to our cosmic logos, in which our sun has a part, and maybe it's particularly colored by one of the six other solar systems, of which ours is one, and so on it goes until maybe we will find, not ultimately, but eventually, a place within the Pleiades, whether objectified or subjectified, within what we are calling the one about whom naught may be said, or our local one about whom naught may be said. The history of the monad, of what is now apparently the human monad, is as old as the cosmos. I'm going to write that down and then say something even more radical, perhaps. History of our monad is as old as the cosmos. Cosmos. But then, what is the monad? It's the ray of the absolute. What is the absolute? Does it have age? It does not. The absolute was never born. The absolute will never die. It is only what it is, and ever so. The infinitesence of all of infinite possibilities, in a sense, already enacted. I've begun to think that, you know, that there's nothing new under the sun, and there are no new combinations, because if the inner absolute is the absolute is absolutely absolute, then there is no possibility which it is not. Otherwise, it's just not absolute. So it has to be in its own nature ultimatized, we might say, the infinity of infinities, and everything in a way that could ever be done, will be done, has been done, is already achieved, already done within it. So our monad, in whatever group form it may exist, that point of participation in cosmos, which may never, well, does it ever really dissolve? Is there a point when for instance, a number of us all become a solar logos and then lose the sense of all that the individualized monads have gone through? Well, then it would be the experience of the still greater being which we all have become. And we would know ourselves as only that. The solar logos is a group being. The planetary logos is a group being. A number of solar angels came together to amalgamate their identities as a planetary logos. This seems to be what DK is saying about the 49 groups, and probably this relates to the way that planetary solar logoi become what they are. The group beings amalgamated from below, as it were. Then we lose our sense that we are any part of that. We only find ourselves to be the whole of that, who has somehow contained all of the parts in its evolution. So in a way, what we are acting out now is the experience of an aspect of a planetary logos to come, or some sort of ray lord to come, or maybe some sort of solar logos to come. And there are other beings who are parallel to us, working out their apparent individual dharma or karma, and yet one day they will find themselves to be, and we in relation to them, the same, who has somehow possessed all of the experiences which were gathered seemingly by an individualized monad. So we are always not only parts of something greater than ourselves, but we are always something greater than ourselves. Well, I know that's paradoxical. We are always something greater than ourselves. Namely, the self that includes all those who refer to themselves as themselves. As them, as their self, well, the English is problematic here, as their own self. Maybe that we can say. Our descent and reascent is not separated from our stellar, our planetary and stellar origins. Our descent and reascent as a monad is not separated from our planetary and stellar origins, and ultimately nor from our universal origin. People will fight hard to maintain the apparent separativeness of the self. It is a natural sort of reaction of the personality consciousness. The idea of giving up this familiar ring past not seems like a threat to life itself. But eventually, there's only one being, so how do we get from where we are now to the one being? And we are that one being, and all of the experiences of the monads and their pilgrimages are just aspect of our one experience. Right now, the one being from whom we all emanated is experiencing as its own experience everything that we are experiencing ostensibly as individual experiences. It's the problem of the one and the many again, and the changes of consciousness which arise. So let's see, we are dealing with the changes of consciousness which arise as the many re-become the one, from whom or from which or which they are emanations. Okay. Well, you know, any one of these thoughts that HPB is proposing here can be a seed thought to help us ramify into other thoughts. Ramification, networking, the World Wide Web, these are all ray 3 correlated with the third ray process. The following five statements are basic. Each of the primordial seven, the first seven rays, we're just dealing with our local system, forming the manifesting logos, is again sevenfold. So we have 49 is a very important number, and it relates to our planes. And relating to the sons of Fohat, sons of mind, or ray sons, and the spirits of darkness, of whom there are seven, just as there are seven sons of mind, or ray mind, Prajapatis, or just as there are seven major sons of Fohat, but they subdivide, and then they probably divide again into 343. So that which forms the manifesting logos is again sevenfold. As the seven colors of the solar spectrum correspond to the seven rays, or hierarchies, each ray is in a way a hierarchy, not necessarily the same as the creative hierarchies we're discussing, but each ray is a hierarchy, or a multi-leveled, hierarchical life. So each of these is subdivided into seven. Well, okay, and as DK tells us, seven again. I was speaking with a scientist who said, well, there's no real reason to limit the spectrum simply to seven. We have other aspects. Maybe if we add ultraviolet and infrared, I wonder about that. So if we add ultraviolet and infrared, we will have the necessary nine, which will correlate with the seven Pleiades. And, well, come on. Pleiades, there we go. And their parents, Atlas and Pleione. So why just divide the spectrum into seven, he said. And then why think that there is something sacrosanct about the seven notes of the scale and other septenates? Well, they do. The thing is, structurally in cosmos, things really do occur in sevens. And I think when the electrical system of the body is studied, we will see this. But then there are also other enumerations that are possible. And since these scientists are not structurally compelled, in a sense, as we are, they just say what they discover, and if the number is not seven, they'll say it's not. Each of these hierarchies furnishes the essence, the soul, and is the builder of one of the seven plus? Ah, is that what it says? Page 637. Let's go here, and we'll see what we've actually got. 637. But we don't want to be in that one. We want to be only in esoteric astrology. And 637. Okay. Each of the... one of the seven, aha, is not plus at all. Seven principles is what it is. Each of the hierarchies furnishes the essence of soul and is the builder of one of the seven kingdoms of nature. And is the builder of one of the seven kingdoms in nature. So there is no plus there. That's just a mistake. Well, we have already discussed... this is what we've discussed. We've discussed the relationship of the rays to the kingdoms. But usually more than one ray per kingdom, and not just one. The three elemental kingdoms, the mineral, vegetable, animal, and kingdom of spiritual man, that's 3 plus 5. Mineral, vegetable, animal, kingdom of man, so that's 3 plus 5 is 8, but let us not forget three more. So in a way, 11 kingdoms, if we were to, is that correct? It should be 7 plus 3, mineral, vegetable, animal. No, it's 3 plus 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, that's 7. And let us add the kingdom of souls, the soul of lives, kingdom of souls, kingdom of planetary lives, and the kingdom of solar lives. Now we have 10. Okay. 10 kingdoms. Probably we can find with 10 planets a correlation, and we will not find that there is... We will find a doubling here of the rays, probably, because we have 7 rays and 10 kingdoms, so there will have to be 3 that are doubled, I suspect. Yes. So what is important here is to realize we are not necessarily talking about creative hierarchies, although each one of them has a ray as well. There is no one creative hierarchy which produces all one kingdom in nature. There is no creative hierarchy, for instance, that produces specifically the vegetable kingdom, specifically the animal kingdom, or the mineral kingdom. One of the things we could say, however, from one perspective, is that the fourth creative hierarchy of human monads, given that there is the in-metallization, in-vegetalization, in-zoonation of the monad, could be, in a way, responsible for the three lower kingdoms other than man. In other words, what we might have is man as mineral, man as vegetable, man as animal. And it could be, in fact, in a way, the fourth creative hierarchy, which is connected with all of those lower kingdoms. It's very hard to connect the kingdoms and the kingdoms and the creative hierarchies. There's no easy one-to-one correspondence. So we have here the three elemental kingdoms of, I suppose, mental essence, astral essence, and physical essence, and then building them into the kingdoms. Now, we would also have to see if there's a particular creative hierarchy connected with these elemental kingdoms, and maybe we would have to say that the sixth creative hierarchy of the manifested creative hierarchies and the seventh are connected with the three elemental kingdoms, because they constitute the source of the tiny elemental lives and also of the aggregated elemental lives. So let us say that sixth creative hierarchy and the seventh creative hierarchy may have a close relation with the three elemental kingdoms. And in this case, what we would have is the two lowest creative hierarchies, and then we would have the one responsible for the human kingdom, and the lesser kingdoms would be the human creative hierarchy. So basically we'd have three hierarchies there responsible for man, all the lower kingdoms, and for the elemental kingdoms. That's three. The solar angels, in a way, belong in a different line. They're already coming in from a previous solar system. And what their true place is may not be at all below the human creative hierarchy, but rather above it. Yet they are manifesting below the human creative hierarchy, as I've said. So then we would have... It seems that all of the kingdoms of nature, up through the kingdom of souls, can be accounted for by three creative hierarchies. The cooperation, of course, of the... I think I better get out the map here. Okay, where is that? I was sure I had it. All right, I don't. But I will get it. Okay, so this is... All right. Fellowship. And the diagrams. And, Yes, type. All right. All right. Preview. Okay. And we'll move forward. And just to this map here. And, in other words, the elemental lives can be accounted for by the lowest, and their aggregations by the lunar lords, and the three lower kingdoms can be accounted for by the human creative hierarchy. As for these lesser builders, divine builders, and divine flames, they are a bit like three hovering above a square. And the square may have to do simply with these three lower creative hierarchies, which account for all kingdoms and also for the, as DK is putting it here, the elemental kingdoms as well. It's a little bit intricate, but the question is, you know, what it boils down to is the question is this: is the member of the mineral kingdom really a man in the making? And thus, for the members of the vegetable kingdom, animal kingdom, and of course the human kingdom. And the kingdom of souls also is listed. By the time we get to the planetary lives, Well, I think you can still be a member of the fourth grade of hierarchy and still be, in a way, a planetary life. I don't think Sanatkumara and his Buddhas of Activity should be called planetary lives. I think, in a way, they should be called solar lives. But we don't know exactly what DK means there by the members of the Sixth Kingdom. Those who are Chohans are said no longer to be men. So does that mean they're no longer members of the fourth grade of hierarchy? Have they in some manner changed their hierarchy? Suffice it to say, we might look at four creative hierarchies and say they are responsible for the creation of three elemental kingdoms and five or even six of the evolving kingdoms all the way up to planetary lives. So six evolving kingdoms and three involuting kingdoms, and the four can be responsible for those. Well, this will take some going into, of course, and I'm just mentioning this as a possibility. Yes, and we are at that point. So I will say that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 149B. And we're not making a whole lot of progress in pages, are we? Page 638. And let's, beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 150, let's start there, page 638. We're going through the astrological references to the secret doctrine and trying to deal with some of the implications of the statements that HPB makes, often in the abstract, and trying to connect them with what DK has said. We want to also discriminate between creative hierarchies and the let's call it hierarchies of lives. Seven ray hierarchies, let's call it that, between creative hierarchies and the seven ray hierarchies. Because the creative hierarchies, though ruled by different rays, are actually collections of monads per se. And the ray hierarchies are, well, it looks like they are the planetary logoi as regents and all of their Devic representatives. That's what it appears to be. So, okay, for the moment then, we'll go on shortly. And for right now, I'll say goodbye and we'll get back to it. We don't know what thoughts will arise in this particular section as we try to connect HPB's views, expressed maybe in different language than DK's, with what DK has said, but we will give this a try. Sometimes there may be repetition, there may be language used, which means one thing in DK and one thing, another thing in HPB. But we do see, as to the seven colors of the solar spectrum, as the seven colors of the solar spectrum correspond to the seven rays or hierarchies. In other words, the seven rays are called hierarchies, whereas in looking at the creative hierarchies, the rays simply rule those creative hierarchies, as do certain signs of the zodiac. But to think of rays as hierarchies of lives is also interesting and important. So, we'll see you soon.